My name is John Bishop. My career to date has involved regular conversations with head teachers and senior school leaders. This is now my 20th year of doing this, and I've learned so much during this time. In fact, I've been able to build several successful educational businesses based on these professional and sometimes personal conversations with head teachers. I often share the wisdom gained from these discussions with colleagues including managers, business partners, health mentors, and other school leaders. As a result, many introductions and connections have been made that have led to exciting and successful collaborations. Now I think it's time that these conversations are shared with a much wider audience. This podcast series consists of interviews with former, current, or future head teachers. Some of these I've known for a long time, whilst others I met for the first time whilst recording their interview. So who should listen to these conversations? Head teachers, who would like new ideas from colleagues who've experienced similar challenges to themselves. Aspiring head teachers who can learn from colleagues who have gone before them in the role. Teachers who want to better understand the pressures experienced by their leaders and managers. Policymakers who may benefit from what's really happening on the front line. And anyone who wants to get inside the minds of school leaders who play such an important role in our society today. All guests have been chosen based on an individual theme which will be shared during their introduction. These themes are of particular relevance to my current work projects of well-being, mentoring and staff culture within education. During the interviews, we also get to know the person behind the role. What made them choose teaching as a career? Are there any key moments or turning points during their career that are responsible for their success? How do they switch off from such a demanding and all-consuming vocation? The podcasts are generally between 60 and 90 minutes long and are perfect for you to listen to whilst commuting to and from work, or whilst walking the dog at the weekend. I hope that you enjoy these interviews and feel free to share any thoughts or follow-up questions on the website or Twitter to keep these conversations going. I first met Paul at a meeting with the Coventry Local Authority. I was asked to chair the meeting to discuss the introduction of Evolve Health Mentors to primary schools within the city. I had not met any of the attendees previously, so it definitely made for an interesting meeting. Although Paul was representing secondary schools at the meeting, and would not directly benefit from the project, he added lots of value and was keen to see it happen. I quickly realised that Paul was an exceptional leader, and when he asked me to stay in touch after the meeting, I was more than happy to oblige. We exchanged emails in the months that followed before meeting at Linghall School with no real agenda or project to discuss. Our conversation was another one that I wish I could have recorded to share with colleagues due to the number of useful insights and approaches that Paul kindly described. I convinced Paul to let me visit him again with my dictaphone so that we could record this interview where we pick up some of the threads from our previous conversation along with a few new ones. This podcast interview is with a secondary school leader, but it is interesting to note that many of the same themes from my earlier conversations with primary heads are still evident, possibly even more so. Paul has an ability to make everything he does sound so simple and makes you wonder why you didn't think of it first. Hopefully, this next 60 minutes will help you to devise something wonderfully simple for your school. Here is my conversation with Mr. Paul Green. So, Paul.
Yeah.
Good to see you again. Thanks for taking some time out to have this conversation. We first met at the local authority where there was a project we were getting off the ground with various different stakeholders that were involved. And we've since had a couple of meetings and... First, actually, before we get into the meat of it, can you tell us a little about Linghall School itself and a bit about the background and some of your pupils?
Yeah. So it's a relatively small, about 800 kids. Colourful, vibrant, exciting place to work where hopefully everyone is very supportive. You know, we work hard to encourage everybody to smile and to be positive and so on. And I guess then we get into the idea that maybe 70% of our kids come from pretty socioeconomically deprived circumstances. There's 46 different languages spoken in the school. We've got over 200 Gypsy Roma kids. A lot of children from Eastern Europe, and then we've got a whole range of other kids who do really well academically. We've got kids who are super talented at music. You know, it's just a real good mixture of inner city kids with lots of talents, lots of challenges, and we're trying to build a school continuously, build a school that actually helps those kids to thrive academically, socially, emotionally, you know, everything.
Good. And that came through in well, every time we speak, really, but the book that I referred to earlier, School of Wellbeing by Jenny Hume. This is the
home.
This is the one where you've contributed a chapter and you've talked about some of your philosophies, and you've also mentioned your approach to mental health and holistic child development.
Yep.
So can you just tell us a little bit about your chapter in the book?
Yeah, it came about as a result of a conversation, something like this, really. But I guess the central point is that I decided that philosophically we couldn't ignore the children's background, we couldn't ignore the children's experiences, we couldn't ignore the fact that a lot of our children come to school each day not knowing whether they're going to be living in the same house when they go home at night. We couldn't ignore the fact that a lot of our children, you know, have some significant underlying health issues that relate to their living conditions and so on. And, you know, we needed to take some responsibility for addressing those issues as well as their issues academically. And at the same time, you know, you sort of become aware as you deal with families and so on that a lot of the families are actually in some sort of difficulty as well. There's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of tension. So actually the last thing you want to do for these kids when they come into school is replicate all of that. So I decided that we needed to do something very different. And so, for example, right in the heart, and let's face it, if teachers don't like kids, then don't be teachers, you know? So, and if you like kids, then enjoy kids. And I'm purposefully calling them kids because I don't like all the other derivative expressions that we use to sort of depersonalize what we're really dealing with, you know? And so a core mantra, I guess, that runs through the school is smile. You know, I expect my teachers to smile. I expect my teachers to show the kids all the time that they really enjoy being with them. And they smile most when things are at their most difficult, because actually that's when the kids need you to smile. You know, naughty kids are not happy kids. So making children happy is fundamentally part of what we need to do around their emotional health and well-being. By the same token, we don't shout at children, we don't use negative language, we don't talk about detentions, we don't talk about punishments, we don't talk about isolation. You know, we don't use those negative terms, but we do all those sort of things. So we do give kids extra help after school if their behaviour means they haven't kept up with the pace of the work. That we do lots of one-to-one work with children to help them understand why their behaviour may have caused a problem for them and for other people. We do lots of restorative work and peer resolution work and so on. But what we don't do is enter into this sort of punitive language with the kids. And the kids respond really positively to that. So kids understand what they've done wrong and they work with us and they come back to school at the end of the day and they do the extra work. And so there isn't that tension about, you know, we're punishing them because of things that they've done. Actually, we're all working together. And by the same token, then extend that to the families. And we've created a workforce that are basically engaged in supporting families with family-related issues that reduce anxieties in children. So so I've got 20 staff at the moment who are engaged in things like helping families to resolve debt issues, homelessness issues, eviction problems, gambling problems, other forms of addiction and so on, or just general things in their life that are making it more difficult for their children to come to school and be happy and learn well. So we issue food vouchers. The school was the first school in the country to become a Citizens Advice Bureau. We did that so that we could get all the resources of the Citizens Advice Bureau that we could then use with our parents. And so, you know, we're trying to create a community that, that is positive, supportive, helpful for parents, for children, but all of us actually never losing sight of the fact that what we're trying to do is improve life chances for kids.
And as a result of some of these measures, have you got any example case studies or impact of what that's actually, the difference that that's made on some of the children who've come into your school at year seven and what that does to them through the journey?
So attendance, if we take a take attendance, our average attendance is over 96%. It's above the national average. Our persistent absence is lower than the national average. And yet this is in a school where demographically both that's out of odds with the expectation based on the nature of the catchment area and so on. So kids are coming to school because they want to be in school. They're coming to school because they see some advantage in being in school. It's a place where they want to... There are some children who come to school every day during the summer holidays or the Easter holidays, and we have staff in school available to work with them. So as an absolute measure, I think that's really... For me, that says something really important about the environment that we've created for the children. For some of those kids, the fact that they come to school every day from year 7 to year 11 and then go on to do GCSEs and stay in the sixth form, that in itself is a huge success, because these are kids that would have dropped out, dropped off, or become disengaged. And I suppose at the other end of the spectrum, we've got more kids going to university now than ever before. We have some real notable examples of individual achievements. So last year, the AstraZeneca Science Student of the Year was one of our students. Rosin Hanjul was named as International Young Woman of the Year by the House of Lords. Because of the work that she's done politically, active around supporting her population. So there are some real, you know, there is a full spectrum of success, if you like, which I think reflects very positively on what we're doing.
Oh, very much so. Certainly the attendance figures there.
Absolutely. Mm. The attendance of our Gypsy Roma children is 95%. That's 20%. Above the national average. Again, because I think we've created an environment where those kids want to be. We've reflected on what their anxieties are culturally, what the pressures are that tend to make them not want to come to school, and we've actively done things to try and reverse that. And just before the Easter holidays, we had a huge cultural evening where we celebrated with food and music and so on, you know, the things about their culture that they enjoy and wanted to share with us. Fantastic.
Right. And is there an expectation on teaching staff here to do more than they would do at other schools? Or are there other staff that tend to look after this pastoral element?
I think, like all head staff, I've probably got an expectation on my staff to do more than I really should. But no... What I want the staff to do is to come to school, be very positive with the children, plan exceptional lessons, deliver outstanding lessons that the kids can then engage with. And at the same time, I've got another group of staff who are entirely dedicated to helping those students achieve a less anxious, more centred, personal, emotional, you know, well-being. So that they're able to access all of that good teaching. Because, you know, you could be sitting in a class with the best teacher in the world, but if you're anxious and worried because you don't know what your circumstances are going to be when you finish school tonight, you're not going to learn properly. You'll have been in situations where you needed to take exams. If you'd have been sitting there scared, you wouldn't have done as well. So, you know, so I expect every one of my staff to understand that, and to actively work to reduce levels of anxiety amongst children as far as we possibly can, and to show them we really care about them, and to model positive relationships all the time, especially when things are going wrong for a child.
So you're really giving me and anyone listening to this a real insight into the school and the approach that you take. And I know you're also very heavily involved with some of the SEN reforms and the Green Paper. And you're also an ambassador with Achievement for All.
Yeah, Achievement for All is a great organisation, actually, and we became involved with Achievement for All in 2008 in a pilot in Coventry. And, I mean, really, in essence, it's based entirely around the principles that I've just described, so that makes it a perfect fit for us. But at the same time, it's not about telling schools what they need to do. You know, we've been through a period of time where there was a one solution fits all type of approach to school improvement and so on. And the real beauty of Achievement for All is it's about recognising good practice. It's about recognising a wide variety of different possible solutions, and it's about bringing people together to share that, so that I can go to Achievement for All events, listen to lots of different success stories with lots of different ideas about how you can improve outcomes for children. I can bring those back to my school and adapt those to my particular circumstances and add those into our repertoire of activities. So, I guess it really was at the forefront of the whole sort of system-led school-to-school improvement programs, really. As you say, I'm an ambassador for Achievement for All. We remain really fully engaged with the programme, because I don't think it matters how much you progress on that journey. You still have things to learn, you know.
Mm-hmm. And are you involved in any? What are the projects you're involved in now? Is there anything new going on at the school?
Yeah, I'm involved now with an EU commission, which is looking at raising achievement for vulnerable children across Europe. That's been fascinating. So I've been very privileged to visit schools in Rome and look at what's happening there in terms of work with vulnerable children. Other delegates have visited schools in Scotland and in Poland and various other places. But it's brought people together. It's brought educational experts and practitioners together from across Europe, where we can actually sit down and explore what are the things that we're doing in our different countries to get the best best outcomes for our most vulnerable children. It's fascinating. Projects coming to the point now where we'll be starting to pull things together, and it should generate some really interesting reports, actually. So I've been really excited about that.
And is there anything you've seen from practice overseas that you've brought back already? Is there anything interesting?
There's always things that get woven into the work that we're doing. One of the things that was really fascinating in Rome is that they don't have any special schools. There are no special schools in Rome, in Italy, in fact. And children with whatever range of need they have, no matter how extreme, are taught in schools alongside all the other children. The resources and the staffing follows the needs of the child. So on occasion, you'd be in a classroom where there were 30 children, there'd be potentially a child in a wheelchair operating a screen with very limited movement, say from a finger or from a chin or something like that. There may be a child who's hooked up to various life support systems. There may in that classroom be four adults who are there either to look after the medical or educational support needs of the different children in the class. But the fundamentally interesting thing about that is when you talk to the children about their friends and who they associate with and who they, you know, go and see in the evenings and so on, there's absolutely no division amongst those children that is based on special need or ability. So, you know, there's the child in the wheelchair or the child with very limited movement is just as likely to have a range of completely able-bodied friends and contribute fully in that friendship relationship as all the other children. And for me, that's a really positive thing. Now, resourcing that must be a huge headache for the Italian government, and I don't know how you'd replicate that easily here, but I fundamentally think those kids are getting a better deal.
Mm. No, that's better. One of the things that we talked about last time was your use of associate teachers.
Yep.
Now, I know currently teacher recruitment and retention crisis, and schools are often struggling to recruit, but you found quite an innovative way of addressing that here at Ling Hall. Explain how that works.
Yeah, my associate teachers, I guess, like a lot of people, I used to have teaching assistants and attendance officers and learning mentors and all sorts of people. And if you weren't careful, you know, a child needing some sort of intervention might end up working with four or five different people. So we basically completely restructured the support staff system and created this one role that we call the associate teacher. Now, they're the associate teacher because they work in association with the teacher. The idea is they work in collaboration with the teachers. The teacher's planning and preparing outstanding lessons, the associate teacher getting children lesson ready. And it soon became clear that if you're going to get a child lesson ready, you can't avoid working with the family. And so the role gradually grew into more of a family work role. And so the associate teachers get training in a whole range of aspects of supporting families, and I mentioned Citizens Advice Bureau earlier. But they basically help and support the children and families to resolve issues largely outside of the school, helping those children to get into a place where they're more able to access the learning in the classroom. Now, at the same time, those associate teachers are working with our most vulnerable and challenging children, naturally, but they also provide all my cover supervision. So all the money that I used to spend on supply teachers, I can now divert into appointing more associate teachers. A significant number of my associate teachers discover that they love the work and they want to go on and train to be teachers. And so when they train to be teachers, they become teachers whose baseline of experience, if you like, has been working with the most challenging, disadvantaged children and their families. They have this amazing understanding of what it is like to be a child, and they make brilliant teachers. In fact, it won't be long, I suspect, before someone who started work at Ling Hall as an associate teacher will become a member of the senior leadership team. It is proved to be a very powerful and effective role within the operation of the school. It's got its own leadership structure, so that there's career progression for people who work through the associate teacher system. There's good crossover, as I've already said, with people training to be teachers. And, I mean, these people work incredibly hard, but I'd like to think with the teachers, that when you see the difference that it makes to the kids, actually it's really rewarding.
Mm. Mm. And there's real parallels with the work of our health mentors in Evolve.
Absolutely.
They make great teachers because they've come from that background. Yeah. They really do understand the challenges that the children have to deal with. Would you say you're an innovative head teacher?
Yeah, I think I am. I'm better at being innovative and creative than I am at maintaining, you know. I like seeing good. Wednesday, I went to a meeting which was looking at the skills gap that exists between the workforce in Coventry and the jobs that are available, you know. And one of the things that was really clear from that is that the huge skill gap is around things like digital literacy, communication skills, numeracy, and so on. And so I came back to school and I thought, you know, actually, what we need to be doing is getting our kids to the position where they're absolutely, totally skilled in those areas, and they can then totally exploit that shortage and get the best jobs that are going around in the city, and they won't end up working in distribution centres and so on. So having had that great idea, I came back to school, put together a team of staff, said, now you go and work out how to do that and deliver it. So I'm good. I'd say I'm good at having ideas and putting teams together to then go away and come up with the solutions. That I guess that can make me a bit irritating at times, but I think I'm also quite good at recognising when I'm getting a little overexcited with initiatives, and people are good. My senior leadership team are very good at saying, you know, slow down a bit. So,
So at what point in your senior leadership career were you able to take brave decisions and look at innovations and partnerships like this, or is it something you brought in to the role from day one?
No, I think that I'm in a school where the power of the vocational program, the power of vocational education, all of that saw our results go up and up and up and up. It offered a style of learning that our kids really enjoyed, and that was fantastic. So we enjoyed significant success around that time. With all the changes that have taken place now to the examination system, so on, our results have come back down and down and down and down. But in the end, that there is something slightly liberating about that, because I can now afford to look at the things that I think are really going to make the difference. You know, no one's telling me that you need to do X, Y, or Z. I'm seriously having to look at an entirely different educational climate and say, how can I create opportunities for my kids to fit into that successfully? And just doing more of the same, or just doing what they do down the road in the school that's got a very middle-class catchment area, that is just not going to do it. So actually, in a way, that promotes, I've got to think differently. I've got to work differently. And because I've always worked in schools like this, I guess I've always been under that pressure. I've always been under threat of being below some sort of floor target here, there, or somewhere else, and coming up with ways and ideas and short-term and long-term ways of scraping my way out of trouble.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. But you said something earlier about...
Somebody said to me the other day, you know, at times in schools like this, you feel like you're one decision away from a major cock-up. And I think there's an element of truth in that.
Well, that's another interesting way of looking at it. But you mentioned you can focus on what really makes a difference.
Yep.
And I'm keen to get your take on what you think really does make a difference for these children.
Well, I think there are two things. It is about it's the relationships that they form, the attachments that they form, and it's about the security that provides, and it's about the reduction of anxiety, and it's about the increase of happiness. You know, I can't get away from the fact that the happy kids thrive, you know. Unhappy kids just don't thrive. So those are the things that matter. And, you know, you need to combine. You know, a lot of our children are living in families where those secure, stable, sustained relationships don't exist in quite the same way as they do for a lot of other families, because the other families don't have that high-level crisis going on in the background. They don't have that high-level anxiety, you know, which makes it very difficult for parents. We've got to provide that stability. We can provide relationships that model stability, that model relentless kindness, relentless positivity. Doesn't matter what you do, I'm still going to be here. And we can show that sort of emotional resilience, and we can help the kids to develop that. I've known staff who have said hello to children every single day for a month and been ignored by that child, and then in the end the kid goes, okay, hello, you know, because you've demonstrated that determined emotional resilience, and that really and that determination to form a positive relationship.
So it's coming through in this conversation again today how determined and creative you've been as a head teacher. But do you see that as a challenge facing new school leaders who are coming into headship for the first time, and they've got targets and they've got the academic focus? And do you think that it's difficult and stifling for them to take these chances because they're at risk of underperformance and Ofsted, etc.? Is that a challenge facing the profession?
No, I think it's a... No, it's a sadness, I guess, the success or otherwise of a school and a population of people is measured by such a narrow range of numbers.
Mm.
You know, we're using a narrowly defined range of numbers to define whether or not a school is good or outstanding or whether it's inadequate or poor. You know, people looking at raw numbers would say that my school was a poor school. Actually, you couldn't be further from the truth. And I think the real challenge, and it's much easier for now, I'm coming towards, I guess I'm coming towards the end of my career. And so, in a way, that's slightly liberating, you know, because what's the worst that can happen? If you're ahead at the start of their career, what's the incentive to come and be an inspirational head teacher in a school that really needs you, that's in a really challenging context? What's the incentive, frankly, if your success is simply going to be measured by this very narrow range of a couple of numbers? There is no incentive, and that's why I think that it is becoming increasingly difficult to get really good inspirational head teachers into schools that really need them. And you know, there are people out there. Every single day I meet inspirational teachers, inspirational leaders, and we need to, you know, we need to be nurturing those people and getting them into those places. And in my ideal world, you know, you relieve them of those very narrow external pressures. Yeah, of course, we've got to have measures of progress and improvement and so on. But they've got to be real measures of improvement and progress, not just a narrow set of numbers that threaten people all the time. Because actually, as a head, in this sort of context, there's a real danger that you become threatened by the sort of annual publication of progress measures.
Mm. Well, children don't thrive in that environment, and adults are human beings too, and I'm sure that's not conducive for improvement in the system. Your philosophy, can you regarding education, is there a point in time or a particular mentor or some where you can attribute some of your philosophies from stemming, or is it something that's just evolved over time?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. When I was at university, there was a lecturer there who was famous for doing, because I did a science degree, he was famous for doing investigational work. And investigations often didn't work, you know. And I can remember that this really used to aggravate a lot of students who've gone through very traditional sort of O levels and A levels, where they'd been very used to this idea of, you know, you get a method, you follow the method, you get the results, you write down the results, you get a conclusion, you write down the conclusion. And his lectures and his practical sessions just simply weren't like that. There was a fair chance that because what you were doing was slightly off the beaten track or slightly out on the edge, there was a fair chance it wouldn't work. But then a significant amount of time would be spent thinking, but why didn't it work? What have we got instead? What was the... And I very quickly realised that what I was doing that was so much more interesting was thinking. You know, I was thinking about my ideas, my thoughts in a context where something hadn't worked were suddenly valid and interesting. And so I decided when I was science teaching that I would expose children to that. And I think right from the start, by the second year of my teaching career, I was working with HMI around developing ideas around science teaching and so on. Largely because I'd gone into the classroom with that idea, you know. We're going to do a science investigation today. I'm not really sure what the outcome's going to be. This is what we're going to do. Let's pool our collective ideas. And actually getting kids to understand that what they thought about this actually mattered and could make a difference.
Mm.
So that was a starting point. And then you apply the same logic, don't you? So if you take that concept out of the science classroom and apply it to a science department or to a school, and you say to yourself, okay, we have here a massive social experiment going on, but it isn't working, it isn't delivering the outcomes that I want it to. So what is going wrong? I think you develop a far more analytical response to the situation and far more creative responses to try and solve the problem. And I think it's just evolved from there. And you know what? It keeps life interesting.
I'm sure Dr. Philip Zimbardo would be interested in coming into the school here to see how you used the school as a social science experiment, yeah, because that's ultimately what it is.
Well, it is one big social science. I mean, I guess it's not an experiment in a sense, but it is one very interesting social system, which traditionally is set up in a very old-fashioned way. There are way too many things in our existing school system, and actually far more things being encouraged into our school system that are almost Victorian, you know. Mm. So where's the evolution?
And you talked there about the science background and the school as a science department, but are there any presentations or events, conferences you've been to where you've heard a speaker talk and they've made you re-examine your philosophy or your way of thinking?
It sounds a little bit trite to say this, but I actually, even as a student, you know, I used to love going to conferences and listening to what people would have to say. What I think I'm good at, I guess, and it just is part of my personality, is I like to listen to people. I like to listen to people's ideas. I find that interesting. I like reading biographies, you know, or autobiographies, because what I'm interested in is how other people think, and then taking their ideas and putting them into my context, and evolving those into my ideas. So I would almost say almost every conversation I have helps to generate ideas or cement philosophies, you know. And it could be it could be anything. There are all sorts of events in my life that I can think of where it sort of changed my way of thinking in small ways. But it could be a conversation with a child, you know, or it could be a conversation with you. It could be anything. So I couldn't pin it on anything in particular.
Okay. And obviously science teacher.
Mm.
And what made you think of teaching as a career?
I couldn't, at that time, I couldn't think of anything else to do.
I've heard that so many times.
And it's a terrible thing, isn't it? It's a terrible thing. What a piece of luck. Mm. Well, I think it was a piece of luck. Whether everyone else does or not is up for debate. But I've done a variety of other things. I'd always been very entrepreneurial, to be honest. As a child, I was always looking at ways of making money. So I'd always anticipated I'd do something a little bit more entrepreneurial. And I ended up working as a research and development chemist for Rimmel, the cosmetic company. And I didn't find that very satisfying. And I think I realised that I needed to work with people, and that I liked working with people, and I liked thinking about how people thought, and then not being manipulative as such, but actually, you know, applying some understanding of that psychology. So that's what naturally led into the idea of teaching, I guess. And I would say I think my personal self-evaluation at that time was pretty accurate, because I can't think of a day when I haven't enjoyed being a teacher.
And do you miss being in the classroom?
I don't miss the marking, if I'm honest. I don't miss... I do still teach. I teach 3 hours a week to this lovely, bright group of Year 7 children who just absorb the idea of doing science. And it's a real delight. But those 3 hours satisfy my need to be in front of a class teaching. I honestly can't conceive these days of what it must be like to teach 21 hours a week. and everything that goes with that. You know, I take my hat off to all my teachers, and teachers everywhere are teaching under that sort of pressure, because I don't think I've got those muscles anymore.
Right, well, I've got two questions on the back of that then. First one, if you could rewind the clock, would you still have chosen teaching as a career?
Yep.
Would you choose teaching as a career today?
Yeah, I think I would, because actually it feeds me too, you know. It does meet my needs. I think it's a real tragedy in a way that we're not promoting teaching as a sort of sexy career. I was talking to some undergraduates earlier in the week, and they just don't see teaching as something that would meet their needs. It's not seen as something that is either valuable, valued, or is going to deliver them the financial rewards that they're looking for. Mm. And, you know, a lot of kids today are looking for financial rewards quite quickly, yeah. I have to say. Yeah. And we've lost that, and that's a real shame, because I think there's a lot of kids out there who would be fantastic. We've introduced a scheme here in the last 3 years where we target students in our sixth form who we think would be really good teachers. And we give them a small bursary towards their university education. We guarantee them a job as an associate teacher in the university holidays, and they come back and work here. And then if they want it, at the end of their university degree, we guarantee that we will train them initially as an unqualified teacher, but then we'll put them through training to become a qualified teacher and give them a career. And that's been fantastic, because, you know, I've now got a succession of kids currently at university, all working in the school as teachers, who I've known since they were 11 years old. And it's fantastic. One of those is just taking up an appointment in September now as a head of department.
Oh, wow. Brilliant.
You know, in another school, unfortunately, but, you know, her career has progressed brilliantly. And that's just another way of looking for ways of keeping good people getting good people into the profession, either through associate teachers or actually recruiting sixth formers. I know these people are going to be good teachers, and we're giving them those opportunities.
Great creativity again. Keeping people that you know and you can trust.
Absolutely.
And you value.
But you know what? How cool is that for kids in year seven when they're being taught by a fantastic Spanish teacher, and that Spanish teacher says, you know, I was at Ling Hall in year seven once. I know what it's like.
Hmm.
That gives the teacher huge credibility, but it also means that that teacher's got a better understanding than me of what these kids need.
And I've got to go back and ask the question. That's 3 hours a week, the delight. Are you doing the marking?
Yeah, but you know, one of the things that I say, and I think it's a really important message that I give, especially to young teachers, you know, if they don't write it, you don't have to mark it. So we don't do a lot of writing in my science lessons. We do a significant amount of assessment, but we do not do a lot of writing, and I mark the writing.
Mm. Okay, good. And is there any other advice you'd give to new teachers starting out, maybe in September?
You know, I think that... No, I'm not... I was about to say that I'm not good. I'm not a great one for giving advice. All of my teachers would say I don't do anything but give advice. Actually, that was just a contradiction. But, no, you know, I think the advice I would give is the same advice that I would give the students. At any point, you know, the things that really matter are being creative, being motivated, being passionate, you know, be excited, be interesting, be positive, and smile. I've blagged my way into so many things and so many projects because I've been interested in what was being talked about, I've been positive about it, I've been motivated by it, I've been what we call possibility thinkers here. So, you know, when people have had ideas, then I'll go, yeah, and you could do this as well. And people go, great. You know, kids and teachers, young teachers, old teachers, whatever, you demonstrate that sort of behaviour in your life, and actually things work, things happen. And celebrate the small things. You know, if you get tied up and worried about all the big gloomy floor targets and stuff like that, then your life becomes it can be miserable. You know, I celebrate the difference that I make to children's lives every day, and I celebrate the small things. I had an email a couple of days ago from a girl, Chloe, in year 11, who I've been working with around her RE GCSE, and she sent me an email, and she sent me a picture, and I've got it here actually. She sent me an email and a picture of the exam paper that I'd helped her with, and it showed on the front that she'd got a C, and she wrote, "Mr. Green, got a C in the RE paper we done together," which I thought was great. And there was a picture of the GCSE paper, and it shows she's got a grade C. And I replied, "Well done, Chloe, you did it. I just helped you think about the answers." And she replied, "Yeah, but I wouldn't have done it if it wasn't for you, so thank you." Right, now that's enough for me.
Brilliant.
That's enough for me. Celebrate those things every day.
Yeah.
And I think you're a better person.
Yeah, very much so. And just following that theme on then, so that's the sort of contact you would have had on a day-to-day basis as a science teacher. Something in you made you want to progress into leadership. What was that thing that made you want to do something slightly different?
I like being in charge. I think, you know, it can't be anything else, can it? I could think of a whole lot of other reasons that I could use that would sound better than that. But actually, I do. I like being in charge. I notice this with my own senior leaders. They all reach a point in their career development when they think they can do the job better than me, you know? And I always reached that point. I was always aware of that. I always reached a point in my career when I was a science teacher when I was thinking, yeah, I can do this head of science job better than you. Or as a deputy head, you know, looking at heads and thinking, yeah, you know, I could do this better than you. Mm-hmm. And actually developing that arrogance, if you like, confidence, motivation to then step up and do it. So I guess I've never been scared of being in charge, and I've always sort of enjoyed the, not the power as such, but the opportunity to make things happen.
Hmm. And can you remember your headship interview, first headship interview?
Yeah, it was a disaster. I didn't get through to the second round because I think I came across as a real cocky bloke who thought he knew the answers to everything. So I didn't get through to the second day. I don't think I had enough substance. Right. I was being ambitious and I was quite young, but you know, I still think they made a mistake.
You still haven't forgotten that. And what about the first one, your first successful headship interview?
Well, that was here. That was here.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, what came through there was the passion, because I love working at this school and I love working with these kids, and I really do have that sort of almost family related, you know, you fight for your family, don't you? So, well, you know, I feel that same sort of passion about this place, and just like in a family, you know, sometimes people let you down, sometimes people exceed all your expectations, but actually, and we see this here when it comes to things like Ofsted or people visiting and stuff, actually when it matters, you all pull together. The kids here are so unbelievably loyal, you know, that they know who is on their side, you know, and who's not. And that loyalty, I think, is something that we should never take for granted. So I think it was passion that got me through the headship interview here. I think it's still the thing that gets me through every day, to be honest.
And were you, was it a new school for you, or were you already working here when...
I was deputy
here. From deputy.
Yeah. I was deputy here for a little while. Actually, it had been in special measures when I came here as a deputy. It was, school was in special measures. We got out of that, and subsequent inspections have all been good. never quite managed to hit that outstanding label that I think we're outstanding. But hey, you know.
Yeah. And how was it walking into school the first day as the head teacher with obviously colleagues who you worked with before, now they saw you in a different position?
Well, I think actually that's a really good question, because I think that was worse, more challenging, scarier than walking into a new school, because subsequently as a head I've gone to other schools and spent short periods of time there as, you know, an interim head or principal. To sort things out while they got somebody in a substantive post. And actually moving into that new setting was an awful lot easier than moving into this, because everyone expected me to be the person I was the day before.
Right.
Everyone expected me to be Paul Green, the deputy head. Well, I wasn't. I was Paul Green the head, because now I've got things that... I'd got an agenda, you know. And it was quite difficult for staff, I think, to understand that transition. And I think it just makes it a little bit more challenging for the person who's got that internal promotion to get everybody to understand that actually, you know, we have got a slightly different agenda now. We are going in a slightly different direction, and helping them to make that transition.
Mm. And have you done much in the way of mentoring other head teachers along the way?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, and you know, but everyone's different. But at the end of the day. The heads that I work with that are successful are all passionate about kids. You know, they want good things for the kids in their school, and there's 100 different ways of achieving that. And you know, as long as you're putting the energy into doing that, in most cases, apart from the obvious things like ensuring really good teaching and learning and all that, you know, things go well. I think the place where people that are newer in their headships sometimes stumble is you sort of make an assumption that if I've asked you to do it, you'll do it.
Mm.
Or if I've thought about asking you to do it, you'll do it. You know, there is sometimes the real skill comes in making sure that people are doing the things that you want them to do, without feeling that you're forcing them to do it, and at the same time you're monitoring the quality with which they're doing it and supportively helping them to do it even better.
Mm-hmm.
If you ignore all of that, in general things don't get done the way you want them to get done, and you've got a problem.
Yeah, I can relate to that. You talked earlier about coming to the... Well, you're nearing the end of your career.
Yeah,
Who knows? But have you got any plans, what you'd like to do next?
No, well, I've got four daughters, right? And so, you know, there's serious cost implications to that, I have to say. A wide variety of ages. They range from 26 years old to 8 years old. And you know, so... There's still a huge amount of work to be done helping them develop their young lives and so on, so that absorbs a fair amount of my time. At the moment, I mean, you know, chronologically, I must be approaching the end of my career. I must be somewhere in the last 10 years, I guess. But I've got no immediate plans because I still enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
You know. One of two things is going to happen. I'm either going to wear myself out and then I'll know it's time to move on, or someone's going to decide that they've had enough of me and I'll be moved on. Either way, I'm sure I'll find other things to do.
And you talked about like reading autobiographies. Mm. Are you reading one at the moment?
What I'm reading at the moment is Alex Ferguson's book on leadership, which is really interesting because he makes, interestingly, he correlates football management with leadership, the role of a head teacher quite often. He uses the analogy quite often in his book, and I think it's quite interesting because, you know, there have been times when I felt that headship could, especially headship in very challenging circumstances, You know, if you're not careful, there's a sense in which head teacher, being a head teacher in those circumstances, can feel like a bit like football management. Do you know what I mean? It's all about the result of the next game.
High stakes.
Yeah, and so on. But I is very interesting. I mean, when you know, looking at where he's come from and what he achieved at Manchester United and so on. You know, he's got a lot of interesting things to say about leadership because you know he is, and he spends a lot of time talking about it, he's essentially having to lead a squad of maybe 20 very arrogant young men, all of whom think, you know, they're right at the top of their game, all of whom are being paid far too much money, and he's got to keep them focused on what he needs them to do and make them work together.
And are there any, is it all non-fiction, or are there any fictional books you're reading or you've enjoyed and you like recommend to avid readers?
No, well, you know, I like reading sort of fantasy, science fiction-y sort of stuff, I have to say. I've adored Lord of the Rings since I was a child, and still, I still read the books now, even though I also watch the films quite avidly. The Shannara series of books has been a fan. Terry Brooks is fantastic. But on the other hand, I'll read anything that is about the Roman Empire. You know, the Cato and Macro series by Simon Scarrow is fantastic. I also have a passion for Scottish medieval history, so anything about Scottish medieval history is also good. But I read in very small chunks, I have to say, normally 2 pages before I fall asleep. And then the next day you go back and you have to read 1.5 of those pages again.
Slow progress.
Yeah.
Slow progress. And other than books, anything else you do to switch off from work?
No, I do a lot of walking, a lot of mountaineering. I love going to the Lake District with the kids. We do a lot of walking in the hills there. They love that, which is great. So they've got their own tick lists and competitive tick lists. And I have to say, the younger ones at 8 and 10 years old are already reaching the point where they can get to the top of a mountain quicker than me, which is which is a bit frustrating. Because I can remember when I used to have to carry them up on my back, you know. So we do a lot of family stuff. As a family is very important to me. You know, visiting older daughters and so on, watching their careers develop. That's all good.
And we touched on this briefly before we started the recording, but many head teachers I speak to, so it's an all-consuming role. It's a yeah. vocation.
Yeah.
And lots of them don't have many friends outside of the educational sphere.
Yeah.
Be colleagues from other schools. But do you have many friends who don't work in education that look at what you're doing and think it's alien?
No, I actually, the majority of my friends are in education, to be fair. The ones that are not in education think that we've got to be mad to do that sort of amount of work for that amount of money. On the other hand, I think they've got to be mad to work for that sort of money to do such a boring job in lots of ways, you know what I mean? So, yeah, no, but most of my friends, I guess, over time, most of the people you meet are in education, aren't they? So.
Yeah. And final question. When you do finally call it a day, how would you like to be remembered by staff and pupils at Ning Hall?
I don't know. You know, I could give you loads of trite answers to that question. And in a way, it would be easy to say, well, you know, everyone will have their own individual memory, I guess, and it's not for me to be too bothered about that. I guess I'm not too worried. It's about whether I think I've done something with real integrity or whatever that matters more. I'd like to think they thought, yeah, he's a bloke who cared about what he did, and most of the time he got it right, and when he didn't get it right, he was big enough to admit it and change direction. Not sure that's true, so they probably won't say that. On the other hand, you know, I remember another head teacher in the city when he retired. Instead of giving this great long eulogy to all the fellow heads about what his motivation had been throughout his career and all of that, he, you know, after the presentation to him for, you know, from the other heads, he simply stood up, put his jacket on, and went, "Thanks, guys," and walked out the door. And I thought, you know, sure, that was cool, you know,
yeah.
Because he knew that his legacy was his legacy, and he'd done what he'd done, and it would be what it would be, you know. And I'd like to think that in the end, I could be that relaxed about it.
Well, I think it'd be a difficult act to follow, that's for sure. So
very nice of you to say so.
Well, thanks for your time.
No, pleasure. Cheers. Real pleasure.